Now, we were going over a passage in Proverbs relative to the matter of womanhood, the value of womanhood, and I plunged in rather deeply to the whole subject. It's a very vital subject. In these days, it's one that's very explosive because people have such warped views on, you know, on both sides of the fence. It's not one over another, but I would say that unless one comes to the subject from the Christian perspective, there's very little hope of really reaching anything of a vital conclusion. That is a conclusion that has vitality in it, life in it. Otherwise, you go by dead traditions and rules and so forth. But as we pointed out last week, the subject is not just related to women, but it, dealing with the subject in a broad enough base, you include the whole issue of human relations. We went over a lot of things last week that were relative to the whole subject of human relationships and not just to womanhood per se. I think one of the poignant underlying premises that we discussed was the matter of expectation, what we expect of others as being a great mischief maker, because we've been stuck with certain concepts or traditions or something, what people ought to be like, and we hang that on them, and then we're disappointed. One of the tragic things in marriage, and maybe one of the most common errors, is what people bring to marriage in the way of expectation of what marriage ought to provide for them. Because to them, marriage is the, to many people, marriage is the ultimate straightener out of all problems. For example, a young lady wants to get out of the house and get a home of her own. She wants to be free. Well, it doesn't take very long in the nuptial arena to understand that you're not altogether free when you get married. She thought she was under some kind of restrictions at home. When she gets her own home, she's got restrictions maybe even stronger. So people who come to marriage trying to, hoping to find in it happiness are making a mistake. If you don't bring to marriage a rather integrated sense of your own life and being, I wouldn't say to bring happiness to it, because that's a frivolous word, but you don't come to marriage with already satisfaction with your life, basically. You're only going to bring dissatisfaction to the marriage. You know, the girl that says, well, I'm lonely, so I'm going to get married. Or the guy, I'm lonely, so I'm going to get married. Well, you have to deal with loneliness on a different basis. Marriage does not solve problems. It raises them. The fellow said he never knew how happy life could be till he got married, and then it was too late. My experience is large numbers of people who are married are trying to get single. Large numbers of people who are single are trying to get married. Switching back and forth on it. But a lot of it, you see, has to do with what marriage is supposed to be. And I think there's a lot of mischief in the manuals that are written, which portray marriage, the home, as a little heaven on earth. And I'm not altogether sure whether that can be sustained or not. It's the earth existence at its deepest, I suspect. I suspect that's the way we have to look at it, at its most complex. Because whenever you take somebody else into your life, another person, you're adding, a double dose or a double, in a way, a double burden of reality, because you've got to, in a way, live for two people after marriage. You've got to resolve issues for two people rather than one person. When you're alone, you could resolve issues in terms of your own particular needs. Now you've got to integrate your resolution of the problem with two different views of it, two different needs, two different attitudes, and so forth. And so it's very complex. It's really even taking on a friend or even taking a girlfriend or a boyfriend is in a sense almost like taking on another job. Because you've got to work out issues off the job that pertain to the two of you, and you get involved with her problems or his problems. So you've really taken on responsibility. So relating to another person carries with it a great deal of responsibility. And of course, that's true of just friends as well as of those that might be contemplating marriage. But there's responsibility in friendship. A lot of these things are basic to the whole ultimate issue of what is a wife? Conversely, what is a husband? What are the roles in marriage, husband and wife? You first have to understand what is a person? What is a friend? What responsibilities go with friendship? For one thing, you're no longer independent in the sense of not having to account for yourself at all. Some people think, well, a great friendship is where you never have to account for yourself and you don't need to tell anybody what you're doing or where you're going, all that sort of thing. And yet, if friendships mean anything at all, they involve care, caring. When you care for another person, you care what happens to them, you see. No use to say, well, call me up in a couple of weeks and we'll talk. There's a caring that says, I want to be sure you're all right. You know, I'm sure everything is going well with you and so forth. So you give up, the moment you take on a friendship, you give up the right to be indifferent to anyone but yourself, you see. And it's a courtesy to a friendship. If you have a friendship, for example, and and you're going to go out of town for a week or two, a matter of courtesy, if it's a close friendship, I mean, they say, well, I'm going to be gone for a week or two, you don't have to go into detail, but rather than just you call a person, you don't find them home for a couple of weeks, and you don't know what's going on. So that's just a mild illustration of what I mean when I say that friendships require responsibility. One of the things that is a part of the friendship, the responsibility of friendship is sharing your cares and concerns or not drawing them into it. Now, for example, if you are going through a difficult period of time, you've got some problems and they're weighing on you and you're with a friend and you're unusually quiet, you're inclined to be maybe a little negative or a little short or ungracious, whatever. And the person wants to know what's the matter. You know, you just seem to be yourself tonight. Well, never mind, none of your business. You know, that doesn't go with a friendship. And I've always said, either share it or don't bear it. You know, in other words, if you're not going to share the problem with them, don't share your pain, see? In other words, don't go around brooding if you're not at liberty to let them in on at least the essence of the fact of why you're brooding. You know, in other words, you don't have to go into all your problems, but they don't know whether it's something they have done personally. See? You've got a friend and they're not exhibiting too much enthusiasm or happiness at seeing you, and you wonder if it's something you've done. See? And the answer is, well, it's nothing, you know, I'll work it out, isn't good enough. So if you don't want to share the burden with them of what the problem is, don't share the pain with them. let them feel the pain of it without letting them know what's wrong in a simple way. That's what I mean by the responsibilities of friendship. The old idea, well, I want to be my own person, I want to be independent, is fine if you want to live alone. You don't want any friends. If you want friends, you're going to have to open up. If you're not going to open up, don't entertain friends. But you owe that to people who pour their life out or their heart out to you, or they open up their heart to you. If somebody opens up their heart to you as a friend, don't mistreated, because they've, in a way, you see, they have put their welfare in your hands, in a way. You see, if you've opened up your heart to them, you've made yourself vulnerable in a sense, and they have a responsibility to protect that vulnerability by proper behavior, say, by being considerate and kind, gracious, and so forth. But it's amazing how, in a marriage matter, it's amazing how gracious and kind and understanding, everything. A man may be, for example, with a woman before he marries her, and then after he marries her, he treats her ugly. It's a terrible thing. Indifferent, careless, maybe he's running scared, you know, maybe he's saying, well, I don't know what I got myself into, but I certainly don't want to get tied down here. This woman, this is a little late then. And so he may feel that he's trying to break out of the trap by being very independent. A lot of husbands are very careless about, for example, letting a wife know if they're going to be late, especially if they're going to be late for dinner or something. They're very careless about that, and they sort of have the old machoistic attitude, well, my business, up to her just to roll with a punch. And that's wrong, because it's a savaging of another person's heart who has opened that heart up to you. So if another person, whoever they are, husband, wife, friend, whatever, if another person has opened their heart up to you, don't savage it. Don't hurt it. I'm not making any particular applications here. It's a very general point. But let me say, it's rather poignant, a rather strong thing to say. If you savage somebody else's heart, normally, before you're through with this life, you're going to get your own savaged. There's sort of a law of that you're going to get cut up yourself. You start cutting somebody else up. The Lord doesn't go with that. Friends are the most precious thing you have. Somebody else in your life, someone to care, somebody that's there for you when you come home at night. It's a marvelous thing, precious thing. Something has to be treasured and preserved and not brutalized. Sometimes couples begin to take each other for granted, you see, and start acting carelessly toward each other. And as I've said, it's so common. Before marriage, everything is so sweet and lovely. And then after marriage, they treat each other very rudely. And that's a terrible thing to do to a human being. Don't treat them rudely. You may not always agree with each other. You may not always have similar interests, attitudes, ambitions, but don't treat each other rudely. There's no call for that. So there's some integration of personality needed. And I've said to you before that every relationship, both marriage and just friendships, stands on its own basis. The way you relate to another person is based upon the implications of your own personalities, how two personalities merge. And you get too many rule books going on this, you see, other than principles. We've been talking about principles, but you start the rule books going, as in marriage, for example, you can get into a lot of difficulty. People are human beings, and they're not computerized. You really can't computerize things, although I suspect that there will be ultimately books, marriage manuals written from a computerized basis. And that will be a sad day when they start working on the statistics and the averages and so forth. Because any friendship is a highly personal thing, you see. So, really, number one point on all that we're saying in regard to human relationships is not to expect too much out of other people. But the second point is to treasure other people as people. Husband and wife want to treasure each other as persons. It's just marvelous to have another person there, as I say. And if you start treating each other unkindly for any reason, you start damaging that fine balance of appreciation and so forth. There are many ways to do that, and we can get into some. But I've used, again, an analogy which I think is very apt, and I've drawn it out for some when I've done marriage counseling. And that is, in discussing the matter of love, which we've done quite a bit here in this class and doesn't need to be gone into too much, but in discussing the matter of affection, which is the human side of things, I've said that marriage is very much like a filigreed vase. Now, filigree means the relief designs on the outside of the vase. So you have a rosebud and a stem or something, that's filigree, and it's raised often, maybe not always, but now that filigree is what gives the vase its character. At the same time, it's the most easily damaged. It's what gives the value to the vase, but it's easily damaged. And those niceties that have represented the relationship between two people in the earlier days can be easily shattered by carelessness, where we are indifferent to somebody, are unkind, are short. Anyone can have moods. Anyone can be short at a time, careless. But it has to be handled. You see, if you're careless with a friend or a marriage partner, you have to make it up. You can't just let it lie. That sign, I guess a bumper sticker that says, love is never having to say I'm sorry. That is a lot of rubbish. It's a lot of foolishness. Because that's the essence of love, is caring enough about the other's feelings that if you have injured them that you're going to apologize. That other is just so outlandish, I can't even believe it. And that's why there are so few really true loyalties in marriage in the world today. But now a lot of people, you see, are brought up on certain kinds of attitudes toward others. And maybe some of their actions stem from family, old family attitudes, perhaps traditions, practices in their own home and so forth. But none of those things are justification for carelessness in one's own marriage. The machoistic male who feels that the woman is a chattel, that is a piece of property, which is not uncommon in some sectors. On the one hand, the machoistic male. On the other hand, the independent female who feels that the husband is just something to wipe the feet on when she comes home at night from her job. Those are two extremes, but there's so much of that. The essence of the thing, of the destructive forces in the matter of marriage today, is, of course, selfishness, self-centeredness, egoism, on both sides, on either side. And the antidote is caring, and caring enough to work at the job of patching up the differences and being careful about the other person's feelings. Being courteous, even just common courtesy. I've just heard so often in homes where I've been and places where I've been, the husband ordering the wife about, you know, get me this, get me that, you know. And I think what a dumb nut he is, because he's going to just savage the relationship. She turns into a servant in his eyes, in her eyes, she feels like that, and she doesn't want to do anything. But what that does is take off the fine filigree of this relationship. And in that filigree, I'm saying the courtesies, the kindnesses, the tendernesses that go along with a love relationship get shattered by a carelessness and indifference after the marriage. Or, if we're talking about just friendships, when the friendship has been going for a while, it can get old. And some of these same things can happen. So, if you're going to live with people, if you're going to relate to people, you have to learn to treat people with kindness and with respect and carefulness, consideration. Whoever they are, whatever they are, they're persons, human beings. Treat them like human beings. Are you talking about the waitress at the restaurant, or the guy pumping gas at the station, or the clerk, a store, a president of a bank, whoever it is. It's just treating all human beings as persons worthy of consideration. Not that their actions are always worthy, but that they, as persons, as human beings, and this goes a long way to helping to resolve some of the conflict that today exists over this role of womanhood, especially. That's been a great bugbear of our present society, trying to sort that out. Well, you have the traditionalists who've been very hidebound about it and laid out the rules and the manuals, you see, and if you dare to vary from those rules, you're going to face disaster and so on. Whereas these are very individual matters and very personal matters, and they pertain to the relationship itself. The point of the issue is, how important is the other person to you? If a job is more important, then you have to go down that road. That is, a person that a career is the all-important thing ought not to marry somebody who doesn't feel that the career is the all-important thing. That's where we get into a lot of trouble. I read an article not too long ago about the executive women, many of whom now are concerned because in the years that they were really marriageable, and in need of a husband and so forth, they're looking for one. They were working on their careers, and now they've gotten to an age in life where there aren't that many out there that they can find to marry. And they have lost a segment out of their lives. So life has always got to be something in balance. And any time you opt for personal advantage over persons, you make a mistake. That is, where career comes ahead of people, or where your own special interests come ahead of your friends or ahead of your family. It's always a bad mistake. You may have to take them along with you in it, you see. But you have to weigh this out. It's not really a matter of time. Things take a lot of time. In business, a man may be stuck with business activities and requirements that just have to be met, and time is required for that. Business doesn't always flow the way we'd like it. We can't just level it all out, have everybody interested in our work in certain periods of the day and days of the week. Sometimes business requires a lot of involvement. Careers require involvement, but it isn't the amount of time involved as much as it is the quality of time. It is the matter of a wife, for example, will forgive a lot of time problems if there's caring when the time is for them to be together, you see. How he approaches her during that time and what he does, how he looks at the matter, is more important than the amount of time that is spent, because I know in our own home situation, time has always been limited as far as my own family has been concerned, and yet we've tried to make the most of the time we have, you see, and tried to be considerate and thoughtful, phoning every day, caring about how things are going with the family, showing care. And I can say it boldly, and I have members of the family here, and I'm not afraid of being contradicted on it, but over the many years, there's always been a lot of ways in which care has been shown, in spite of the fact that time has not always been available. But they do know that when the time is available, we care. All of these things go under a broader heading that says a lot of the debate today and argument would be resolved if the people involved were coming from the Spirit of Christ in the matter, and were coming to one another in a spirit of caring and love and interest, and not in the independent, well, to heck with you, I'm going to do my thing attitude. We can't have that. I mean, that's not going to solve anything. Even if you had the rules down in black and white, it's not going to solve anything if the attitude isn't right. That's why I say, unless you come from Christ in these matters, there's no debate. There's no basis of debate. If you have a problem in a marriage, and both people earnestly are seeking the mind of Christ in a matter, it's going to be resolved. But if we're not seeking the mind of Christ in a matter, it doesn't matter what our own human attitudes are. They're not going to be of great value anyway. See, it isn't a matter of whether or not a woman ought to do this or ought not to do that. It's a matter of what Christ wants her to do. If she only does it because, let's say she has something she wants to pursue, some course of action, and the husband does not want her to do that, and she reacts against it, but she goes ahead and follows his instructions anyway, but resentfully, that's no solution at all. But if she does it for Christ's sake, you see, if she says, Christ, what do you want me to do in this matter? And together with the husband, they work that out. And if both parties in that situation really want to do what Christ wants, you're going to get a resolution of it. Those are fundamentals to this thing. Now, the text that I picked here, which I read last week, but opens up this whole issue. The price of a woman is far of rubies. Well, you see, that's what we're looking at now. Where does this price come from? Where does the preciousness come from, and B, how do we preserve it? The Lord says a woman is precious. Now, as a ruby, and a man thinks of his wife, and he says, gee, I don't know that I can say that. And I'm asking, where does this come from? How can we regard this woman as precious? The things that the proverb says here about the woman, it says that she is, verse 10, who can find a virtuous woman, for her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, so that he will have no need of spoil. But that line is priceless. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her. Well, that's a two-edged sword, a two-way street. The heart of the wife may safely trust in her husband. And you have a friend, and they have committed their heart to you. Don't savage it. That's a basic premise, and people are savaging each other all the time, blasting away each other, treating each other rudely, treating each other indifferently. You may go through moods, and you say, well, you think to yourself, well, I can justify this because I'm in a bad mood today. Well, all right, be in a bad mood, but you may sacrifice the keen edge of the friendship on that, see. There's a limit to how much people can be expected, and you might say, well, he has to love me anyway. He doesn't have to love you anyway. He has to care for you. He doesn't have to like you, and you don't have to like him. If a husband acts rudely, you don't have to like him. If a wife acts carelessly, you don't have to like her. You have to care for her. Now, that puts it on a different basis, where you have to, if you want the friendship of your wife or husband, you have to, in a way, earn it by the way you treat each other. Now, in the question of women working, for example, where this whole thing becomes extremely crucial, and that's why I said we're going to get into some crucial subjects. The foremost issue in any home is, what does the Lord want? And what will please the husband and the wife in the matter? If a man and wife, both Christian people, have married in Christ, they feel he's directed them in their marriage, and they face these crucial issues, and they both really want to do what Christ wants, there will be enough submissiveness there to resolve the issue without bitterness. In the ultimate, the consideration in the whole matter, I'm about to say regarding a wife working, has to be others, in the sense of what about the children, and what about the needs of the husband, what about the needs of the family. And the woman who just gets a monolithic attitude toward, says, I have a right to work. Yes, you have a right to destroy your marriage, too. I'm not saying she shouldn't work. I'm just saying the situation has to be looked at from the point of view of what is best for the home, what is best for the family, and not from the point of view of what is fulfilling for me personally. See? And this is the criterion used by the world at large today. What you have a right to be fulfilled. Well, when you marry somebody and you have joined yourself to their life, personal rights have to be reconsidered. But the general attitude today, you have a right to fulfill yourself. To heck with the children. You know? I mean, they'll have to get along. So I hear it everywhere. Or the husband, you see. It isn't whether you have a right to be fulfilled or not. That is looking at it totally from the secularistic point of view. It's a question of what does the Lord want you to do? Now, if a woman has a career that she feels the Lord has given her and she wants to follow that career, she wants to be married, it has to be something that is in agreement with her husband. I can't put a rigid point here and say no wife ought to ever work. I wouldn't do that, of course. Nor does this proverb even do that, because there it says the woman buys a field. She's apparently doing some business activities and looking well to the needs of the household. So that in itself excludes the idea that a woman shouldn't work. But it's not a question of whether or not she has a right to work. It's not a question of whether or not she has a right to earn extra money or right to be fulfilled. There's only one question. If you're not going to face this question, don't worry about the rest. Just do what you want. Is this what Christ wants for me and for our home? That's it. And if two people are praying about it and they both want to do what the Lord wants, and only the individual really knows that. Most people want to do what the Lord wants as long as it agrees with their plans. I hear it all the time. I just want to do what Christ wants. But I'm not sure down to the nitty-gritty that that's really true. It's only an aphorism, you see. Submissiveness to Christ is doing whatever He wants, whether it goes against our own particular desires or not. To be submissive only in the things we agree with is not submissive at all. Again, to be to agree to do something but be bitter about it is not submission either. That's why I said, if a person does something, if a wife does something just because of the husband and hasn't integrated that in the name of Christ, it's not really submissive. Now, of course, the husband, on the other hand, has a major responsibility to be the kind of person a wife can be submissive to. If his attitude is personally selfish, simply interested in his own welfare, he's not carrying his end of the bargain, where he's got to be a head of the home under Christ. The stature of the husband as a man of faith, a man of prayer, a man of kindness and love and so forth, the stature of the husband will make a lot of difference in terms of how a woman views her own life and how much she really wants to please him and relate to him and be submissive to him. So if a man expects a woman to be submissive to him, and there is an issue certainly in the New Testament of submission, submissiveness, which means that one is open to her husband as to a man of God, but if he isn't that, if he doesn't have that kind of stature, it's very difficult for a woman to really be submissive to him. And that gets us into a tough situation. But I think, again, a lot of these problems are resolved at the level of the woman and the man, each one, coming to grips with themselves as an individual, as a human being, and asking, what am I willing to give or to do for friendship, for camaraderie, for preserving the precious treasure that I have? And that goes both ways. But it's so easy to destroy that treasure and so hard to recover it, you see. We let things slip through our fingers by being careless. And in a way, there comes a time when you have scarred a relationship. It's very difficult to recover that. The tenderness, the gentleness of the original relationship, because it's been scarred too much. It's not beyond recovery, it's just difficult. Every time you feel tempted to let go and blast away at somebody or say hurtful things, remember the words of the old tent maker. The the moving hand writes and having writ moves on, or all thy piety or wit is able to call it back to cancel half a line, or all thy tears wash out a word of it. Things are said that scar the relationship, and people get careless about it, and they know it. How many, many times people have been in the midst of an argument and said things that they know are cutting the other person. They know they're hurting them, and they want to hurt them. They feel vengeful. Well, that's a sure formula for disaster, for a relationship. You can just cut the other person up and destroy the vitality of that fine interaction with one another. When we are with people, people are not digits or pieces of a puzzle. They're human beings, and we have to relate to them as human beings and not to objects of rules and regulations. Each case has to be handled on its own merits. Each personality has to be adjusted to the other personality on its own basis, you see, and we can't just put rigid rules out about who ought to do what and why. Well, I've gone over tonight. Oh, we got started a little late.